Today I'm going to be continuing on in my series, God Is Not Abandoned, as we look at the book of Esther. And I wanted to start out by sharing something that happened a little while ago. Some of you have probably heard it from my kids, but it's a reminder of how things can change really quickly. I think it was Mike and Deb's corn roast that night. We were getting ready to go to their place, and we all get in the car. We're kind of a little later than we wanted to be, so all of a sudden we're kind of rushing to get everything. Then we all get in the van, and all of a sudden Juanita's like, "Oh, I forgot something." So we sit there and wait while Juanita runs into the house and grabs whatever it is she forgot and came out. And so then we head down on Highway 73 and we get almost to County Road V. And as we're not too close, but we can see it, the intersection pretty clear. And all of a sudden, a semi truck just barrels right on through that stop sign, right into Highway 73. It braked hard. I mean, you could see the smoke from the tires going, but it still went right on through. And, we as a family, we ended up talking about that. It's like, had we been in that intersection at that moment, life could change in a blink of an eye. And if Juanita hadn't forgot that one item, is it possible we could have been in the intersection? Maybe. Maybe we would have been past it. But I know that we talked as a family. We really thanked the Lord that we weren't there, because the outcome could have been very different. But after a while, I'm thinking, is it coincidence that Juanita forgot that? Was it divine intervention or divine influence that caused us to be a little later than we were supposed to be? I'm always going to lean towards divine. I don't believe that was a coincidence. I believe that God knew that there was going to be a prayer request before we even knew what to ask for, and that He answered. But at the same time, as I was preparing for this message, I realized that there are times tragedies do occur. And then the question moves to, why, God, did you not intervene? Why did you not answer the prayer that we were going to pray before we got there? And those are really tough questions, because the whys are often left unanswered. And we look at Esther and her life, and she may have questioned why. Why were her parents allowed to be... we're not even sure how they died. Why were they allowed to die when she was young? Why was she taken and forced into the king's beauty pageant? I'm just going to call it that. Why did she have to go? Why was she not allowed to have a normal, ordinary life? To instead of being this queen at a distance, why was she not allowed to be an ordinary wife and mother? Why? But we know that in spite of her difficulties, that God was at work and had a plan for Esther. We know that because we can read about it in the book of Esther. We see it. But that's not the only place where God was at work. Esther's adoptive father, Mordecai, was also very much a part of that plan. That plan included raising Esther as his daughter, raising her and teaching her about God. And if that wasn't enough, he was also used in protecting the king and having a role in the protection of the Jews. If you want to turn with me to Esther 2:19, and let's look at Mordecai a little bit more. Actually, I'll probably start reading in verse 18, but Esther 2:18. And the king gave a great banquet. Esther's banquet for all his nobles and officials. He proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality. So that was something we saw last week after Esther was crowned queen. And then verse 19, when the virgins were assembled a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, but Esther had kept secret her family background and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her to do. For she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions, as she had done when he was bringing her up. During the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officials who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were hanged on the gallows. All of this was recorded in the book of the Annals in the presence of the king. So Esther is either at her banquet or after, we find Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. What exactly was Mordecai doing at this gate? It's all speculation. Some say Mordecai was an official that was working at the gate. And the king's gate would have been a place where business and other important things took place. We also will see that punishments were handed out there too. And it really doesn't matter why he was there and what he was doing. The point is that he was there, and while he was there, he overheard an assassination plot against King Xerxes. He was at the right place at the right time. Again, I will say this, as it's divinely orchestrated. But Mordecai must decide, what should he do with what he knows? Does he reveal it? I think it's interesting in this story, we just see that he hears the plot and then he reports it to Esther. But did it take him a little while to figure out what he was going to do? Is King Xerxes a good king? No. He's not a good king. And the very girl whom he raised was plucked off the street and taken by this king. Should he say something? So let's maybe turn that around. Maybe you like our president of the United States today, maybe you don't. If you were to hear an assassination plot, and you don't like him, should you say something? So when we're looking at this, we're seeing that, okay, Mordecai has a decision to make. Should he say something? If he doesn't say anything, would Esther be in harm's way if the king dies? Will she be in harm's way during the assassination? Will she be in harm's way because she would be the old king's wife, the old queen? Is her life in danger there then? But then if he does say something, his very own life might be in jeopardy from the conspirators. Maybe there's more than just two. He knows about the two. If he does say something, who will believe him? If he does say something, will Esther still be in danger? And I think the biggest question becomes, should he get involved or not? Maybe just keep quiet. Should he get involved? So Mordecai, he decides he's just going to tell Esther. And she proceeded to take that then to the next level. She ends up telling the king, and after the king's men check it out, they find out that there was indeed a plot against the king to kill him, and the two men are hanged, and the whole incident was written down in the book of Annals. This book is simply an official record of the events under the king, and this is an important detail that will come back to play a little later, probably in maybe three messages down the road, two or three messages down the road, this will come into play. Again, divine influence puts Mordecai in the right place, in the right time, for the reason to save the king and ultimately to fulfill a part of God's plan. Now that's a short story in this passage I'm tackling today. But there's more to come. And I think it's kind of interesting, as we read on, we're going to see that there's more drama. Yes, this story is kind of like a modern day soap. It's got drama, and then, hey, there's some more drama too. So let's read on in chapter 3, verses 1 through 6. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore they told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for if he had told them, he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. So here we see this man we're introduced to him as Haman. He's like the second person in charge. He's in a very powerful position of authority. And the king commanded that all kneel or pay honor to Haman. Now, the question is, was it a full kneel where they get down on their knee, or was it kind of like what we see in Lunt or in England where it's more of a head bowing or a curtsy? I would think probably the latter versus all the way down, but it's not really for sure. Mordecai is simply not going to do it. I think Mordecai, he's faced with another decision. He's faced with a decision, does he kneel to Haman or not? And a lot of questions come through as I'm preparing this. Would Mordecai bow his head to the king but not Haman? We don't know that. But we know that Mordecai would not bow before Haman and was directly disobeying the king's command. Well, is that civil disobedience? Was Mordecai not kneeling because he would only kneel to God, bringing back memories of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego who refused to bow down to the idol? Again, we really don't know Mordecai's reason. But we know that it enraged Haman. Haman was so wicked that he didn't want to just lash out at Mordecai. He wanted to punish and destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews. I'd like to read verse 6 again here. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, Haman scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews, and this is throughout the whole kingdom of Persia. There's actually a connection between Haman and Mordecai that dates long before they were even born. If we go back, you don't need to turn there, I'm not going to read out of it, but you, if you're wanting to go back later and read it, please do. 1 Samuel chapter 15. King Saul is the first king. King Saul is the king of Israel, and he's of the tribe of Benjamin. It's the same tribe that Mordecai is from, which we saw, I believe, when we read last week, that Mordecai was of the tribe of Benjamin. But at the time, the prophet Samuel tells Saul that God has said to attack the Amalekites and destroy them, everything. Destroy it all. People, animals, everything. Saul doesn't do what he's told. And he finds out that partial obedience means disobedience. Saul found out that partial obedience meant disobedience, and the Amalekites were not fully destroyed. But where's Haman from? We're specifically told that he was an Agagite. At the time that Saul went to fight against the Amalekites, who was the king of the Amalekites? King Agag. Now there's question as to whether Haman was truly had a true genealogical heritage to the Amalekites. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But I find it interesting that in this book of Esther, that we see Mordecai is specifically referred to as from the tribe of Benjamin, and Haman specifically from Agagites. I believe, since they are listed there, that we can understand that there is an age-old hatred of Jews from Haman's heritage. Haman, after hearing of the Jews' presence in the kingdom, Haman wanted to exact revenge, even if this happened from long, long, long ago. That hatred was passed down. Are we seeing consequences of King Saul's disobedience from long after? That's now affecting the Jews and Esther at this time? I think so. Sin and disobedience have a way of filtering down generations. And I would say, read 1 Samuel 15. King Saul only had excuses for his disobedience. And we see the same today. We see the same today. People often want to make excuses of why they sinned or disobeyed, trying to maybe deflect blame or to give a good reason for it. Anyways, Mordecai and Haman have a history between their peoples. Is that a reason that Mordecai would not kneel? Again, maybe, but we don't know. With Haman's deep-seated hatred, this sets into a motion a plan to destroy the Jewish population. Now some might wonder, is God punishing the Jews in Persia because of King Saul's sin from long ago? I don't think so. But I can get a better understanding of why God wanted King Saul to completely destroy everything, as he knew that they would be the enemies of Israel or the Jews for centuries. The consequences of King Saul's sin didn't just affect him, it affected many others, and that's really how sin is. It usually doesn't just affect the person who's committing the sin. It affects those around us, maybe even those who come after us. Sin is serious, and it causes waves of consequences going outward. Anyways, let's move on and see this devious plan that Haman comes up with in verses 7 through 11. In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, they cast the pur, that is the lot, in the presence of Haman to select a day and month. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Xerxes, "There is a certain people dispersed and scattered among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom whose customs are different from those of all other people and who do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury for the men who carry out this business. So the king took his signet ring from his finger, gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. Keep the money, the king said to Haman, and do with the people as you please. It's interesting as we read this. If you're not Jewish or you don't have much knowledge of Jewish traditions, you would not know that verse 7 has a particular significance. In that verse, we see the officials or Haman casting a lot on which to select the day that the Jews would be destroyed. That lot is called Pur. In Judaism, there is a feast called Purim. It is a feast that celebrates God's salvation of his people from the Persian genocide. And during Purim, the book of Esther is often read as a way to celebrate and remember what they're celebrating. Kind of interesting, but that was a rabbit trail. Again, getting back to our passage here, we see King Xerxes getting advice. We've talked about King Xerxes doesn't always get the greatest advice. He really knows nothing about this people. And Haman is manipulating Xerxes, and Xerxes really doesn't look into the matter. He doesn't verify. He doesn't look at it himself. And the king just gives Haman a signet ring, which is used to certify or enact a decree as coming from the king. Haman simply just says that there's a people who are different and they don't obey the king's commands. All the people are being lumped together. Some might say it was just Mordecai who wouldn't bow or kneel. But with Haman's hatred for the people, it really wouldn't have mattered if Mordecai would have bowed or not. I think Haman would have found another person or another reason or another excuse. So that, because he was wanting the destruction of the Jews no matter what. And I would say the king lacks wisdom. He says, do what you please. The money Haman was promising would most likely come from plundering the Jews that are killed. But the king, he surrounded himself with bad people like Haman. When I was going through my studying here, something came to mind that I wanted to share. 1 Corinthians 15:33. Do not be misled. Bad company corrupts good character. Does that verse apply here? When I think these are two bad characters, King Xerxes and Haman, they're not great characters. But I will say that bad company corrupts. It doesn't matter. It'll corrupt even more. It'll take bad to worse. Wisdom and vice are only good if they're godly. And we have to take our circle of family and friends seriously on who do we surround ourselves with. Who has the ability to speak into you? Are they people of good character? Godly character. Psalm 1:1-2. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, or stand in the way of sinners, or sit in the seat of mockers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked. Where do we get our counsel from? The best character builder is the counsel of God's Word that never gets old, is never out of touch, and always brings wisdom. Though the king did not know all the details, he was essentially signing the death warrant of the very man that saved his life just a little bit earlier. He signed the death warrant of Mordecai and all his people. And Mordecai is the one who just saved his life. He was signing a death warrant for his wife, the queen, because he failed to understand the gravity of the situation. Would they really have killed the queen in the palace? Later on, Mordecai would say that she wouldn't be spared. Now, we make decisions every day and we have consequences to those decisions. Who are we allowing to influence us? And are they dragging us down or encouraging us to draw closer to the Lord? What I like about this part of the story is that we know that God has been divinely influencing things that would bring shame upon Haman and ultimately a way of salvation for the Jews. But let's get real. This is a dark time for the Jews in Persia. The decree was written in many languages and then sent and dispersed all over the kingdom. Let's read about that in verses 13 through 15. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and little children, on a single day. Now, I will say, this is reminiscent of what God told King Saul to do of the Amalekites long before this happened. And now we're seeing that come back around in an opposite way against the Jews. It was on that single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so they would be ready for that day. Spurred on by the king's command, the couriers went out and the edict was issued in the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered. If you were a Jew during this time, would you wonder if God has not abandoned you? This is truly a scary time, but then there are times in our lives where we might feel like God has abandoned us. And we're going to see next week the results of the Jews of this decree of death. We're going to see a lot more taking place, but this was a hard time, a difficult time. And we might have difficult times in our lives as well. In the last couple Sundays, I've read Proverbs 3, 5 through 6, and I want to read it again. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will make your path straight. When we feel like God is distant, this passage becomes even harder. It becomes harder to truly trust God when we really don't see Him working. When we cannot see the outcome, when God's divine influence may not be understood or seen, trusting Him becomes harder and harder. But it's stories like Esther and others like it that help us to not give up hope. Not to rush to our own devices, not to rush to our own understanding, but instead to remain focused on trusting in God in all times and in every way. For if we trust and follow Him, remember, He has promised to work for our good. We need to surround ourselves with people who will encourage us to walk in step with God as well. Those people who will encourage us to keep trusting and not give up. Who will give us wise counsel in following God's word. And I realize that many of these last several messages have had a similar ending theme, but I think that's the point. We need to be reminded regularly that God has not abandoned those who trust Him. He has not abandoned us. God is influencing things even in the most tragic of times, and we look forward to seeing something good come from them that may have been intended for evil. Again, these are just encouraging. These messages remind us of how important it is to trust Him. And I understand that when tragedies fall, it is really hard. I think for Esther, just one thing after another after another, it's like, Lord, when do I get a break? But there's a good ending. And we'll keep looking at it as we go through them.